Have you ever thought about how valuable it would be to get career advice from a top executive? Have you ever wondered what management really thinks about diversity? Join us as our C-suite guest shares with our Latino community their unique insights on professional development and diverse leadership.
Welcome to C-Suite, the show that combines surprising leadership insights with a focus on diversity. I'm Joe Kwan, the Connection Counselor and VP of Board Development for Alpha New Jersey. Today, we have an impactful guest, Manya Bunch. Manya is a seasoned attorney and certified DEI leader who currently serves as Wilmer Hale's Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Manya's legal background includes over 10 years of private law firm practice, in addition to serving as in-house counsel at a brokerage services firm. Also, Manya served as an adjunct professor at Howard University School of Law and the University of Maryland, College Park. She served as a law clerk for the Honorable Damon J. Keith, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and has been recognized by Washington, D.C. Super Lawyers Magazine as a rising star and profiled in Washington Lawyer Magazine. She recently received Diversity Journal's Black Leadership Award, which honors individuals who are trailblazers in their field and promote diversity and inclusion. Manya earned a JD from Howard University, where she served as editor-in-chief of the Howard Law Journal, an MPA from the University of Hartford, an undergraduate degree from Hampton University, and Georgetown University's Executive Certificate in Strategic Diversity and Inclusion Management. Manya was born and raised in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, and is a proud graduate of Brooklyn Technical High School. Welcome, Manya. In this exact moment, what are you feeling and what do you think is creating this feeling?
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's quite a mouthful. I think I'm feeling a number of things today, but I think the thing that really stands out, if I had to identify one feeling, is just gratitude and gratefulness. There's so much happening in the world today. We're waking up and, you know, I've been talking to people who are, you know, suffering or grieving or afraid. And it's really, I think, a gift to be able to be in a position where I am able to kind of galvanize leaders and community and try to build around people and try to offer support. So, you know, I wake up feeling just grateful and gratitude to be in this position. And then to be here talking to you, which came about through, you know, one of the people, someone I think is just one of the best people in the world. So the shout out, you know, the sort of golden approval from Tommy Robinson, who is a great mentor of mine, really stands out too. So for all of those things, I think overall I'd sum everything up with, I'm just feeling really, really grateful and a lot of gratitude.
No, I love that. And, you know, something that resonated as you were sharing that, you know, you obviously do a lot in the diversity and inclusion, you know, space, that gratitude, a lot of that comes from understanding other people and that our world, there's more to the world than just sort of our narrow slice of it.
Right. Absolutely. It does. And it's, you know, and it's something I feel like, you know, we're here for a purpose, and it's something to be able to use, you know, yourself to be able to empathize and to just be able to influence and support. So, you know, you have to take care of yourself, of course, but I do think that, you know, when there's so much more that we're here to do, and to be able to feel like you're in your purpose is definitely a gift.
Well, I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Let's get into it. If you please, tell us a little bit about your upbringing, Manya, and how it informs your perspective and who you are today.
I don't know how many people shout out their high school, but, you know, Brooklyn and Bedford-Stuyvesant and Brooklyn Tech, and if you know anyone from Brooklyn Tech, it really is. It's a high school that had over 4,000 students, and we joke that you could be anywhere on the planet, and there's someone from Brooklyn Tech. So those are sort of the key foundational things in terms of who I am and my kind of developmental years of growing up in Brooklyn. But I think one of the most impactful kind of aspects of my upbringing was I was born in Brooklyn, but at 6 months, my mom, who was a teacher, and at that time a single parent, sort of shipped me to North Carolina, which is common in those days. So I stayed with my grandparents from probably around 6 months to about 3 years old until I was able to come back to New York and go to school. And then I would spend every summer in North Carolina. And so I'd shift from this very urban, busy city life to North Carolina, where the first 6 years of my life, I think we lived in a house that didn't have indoor plumbing. So I'd go from New York City, Brooklyn streets to running around in North Carolina and being around my grandparents and members of my my mom's family, a lot of them not formally educated, but very smart, full of influence. And everyone just sort of, you know, doted on me in a way that that was unusual. I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, my great grandmother. And I think it really built up a sense of just kind of curiosity about people, understanding that one's circumstances doesn't determine one's value. And I think it really helped me over the course of time just become relatable and have a sense of relatability to people from all different aspects and just have a curiosity about really knowing who people are. And I think that foundation which has just been really impactful and sort of a guiding light in terms of how I look at people and how I look at life, but also the self-affirmation I got in terms of what I could do and what I could be in this grand world that we have. So
it's interesting. You were effectively bridging two worlds from a very early age, getting a taste of diversity in your own family. Forget about in the community, but in your own family.
Absolutely. And it was a lot of, we talk about code switching. It was a lot of code switching back then. You know, I'd pick up a country accent, a Brooklyn accent. I knew I had to enunciate when I was talking to my mom, but I would go into the vernacular when I was back with my grandparents. So yeah, at a very early age, you learn to make those adjustments.
All right, so I have to ask, you know, the story of the country mouse and the city mouse. If you had to choose, would you say you're a country mouse or a city mouse?
Oh, that's been, I am a city mouse with country mouse values.
Okay.
I'm very cosmopolitan. I'm a Brooklyn girl, but you know, it will come up. I also walk the streets of New York and randomly say hi to strangers, which, as you may know, is not typical.
Not very East Coast.
Of New Yorkers. So it's a balance, definitely.
Yeah, well, I mean, we share some time in the greater, you know, DC area. I went to Georgetown for law school and also to UVA for undergrad. And I remember in Charlottesville, like, it was so unusual. People would just walk up to me and be like, hey, how you doing? So I'm like, what do you want?
Exactly. I wasn't used to that. Exactly. Yes, I would get that a lot coming back. You know, sometimes it would take me a day or two to make the adjustment, and I'd walk down and people would look like, do I know you? But mostly people adjust to and say hi and then just kind of look at you quizzically and keep it going. So
you know, you're having this childhood with relatives who are taking good care of you, doting on you, learning, you know, all sorts of different perspectives, you know, as you're growing up and starting, you know, school. When did you know that you were meant to be more? Was there a general expectation or a singular moment? You know, where did this come from?
Yeah, I talk about my mom, who was the oldest of eight in her family. She was the only one to go to college. She left, she's raised in a small town, Enfield, North Carolina, went to college and became a teacher. And my mom was sort of a guiding light for the family and for her siblings. So almost by default, or not even almost, by default, being Dorothy's daughter came with it an expectation, and I was her only child. You know, and I remember as a child, it would annoy me because even if she wasn't in the room, there was this expectation of what Dorothy's daughter would be, would do, would not do. So I think a large part of the expectation came from who my mother was, and how She supported my family and my family looked up to her. And then it was sort of mine to mess up or to take with it and do with it what you will. And I think I early on, you know, received that affirmation that there was an expectation that that I was smart, that there would be excellence, that I could do whatever I wanted to do. You know, no one quite remembers how I learned to read, but I started reading at 3 years old when I was with my grandparents. My grandmother had a fourth grade education. My grandfather did not read at all. We later had a lot of fun in my older years with me helping him learn how to read, which was a great bonding time. But I think they would put me out and I would read books and read in front of my family. And it was just an expectation that the world was sort of my oyster. So I think that just came by nothing that I did at that time, just kind of who my mother was. And then as I got older, my mother just always kept me informed. She kept me informed about Black history, about American history, about culture and the arts. And, you know, I was always reading and always curious and always wanting to learn more. And I think that was fostered by my teachers. Once I started school, I went to public schools in Brooklyn, and you know, there weren't a lot of resources, but I had teachers who poured into me. They would often pull me aside. And you know, I think from probably third grade to about sixth or seventh grade, midway through the year, I would just get the rest of the curriculum. You know, my teachers would realize that they would focus on, you know, the larger student population, but would encourage me. So I'd get the questions and the answers and the teacher's handbook, and was able to just sort of go at my own pace. So I think early on, education just afforded me the confidence that I could figure out what I wanted to do and that there would be no parameters around that. And that's a gift. It's not something that, you know, I take for granted. You know, it's not something that everyone gets, but it's been a model in terms of when you have expectations for children growing up, you know, that how that can resonate and how that can affect what they see for themselves.
Yeah, it's so interesting. What you're saying resonates so deeply. You know, learned something recently about the difference between performance and success, this great book by Albert Laszlo Barabasi called The Formula. And one thing he talks about is performance is greatly dictated by our own expectations, right? And what you described, it resonates so much because, you know, before you had your own expectations, your mother sort of guided you. That is a gift. She guided you to those high expectations. Now, they're yours to accept or reject, right? Especially as an adult. But that really informed you versus if she had very low expectations for you, then it becomes much harder for you to find high expectations for yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's spot on. It sounds like an interesting book too. I'll add it to my list.
Yeah, I'll share it with you. You know, one thing that's interesting to me, especially around the work that you do, is if we bring it into the adult professional workspace, it's the expectations that our peers may have of us, perhaps not based on our performance or even our credentials, but on things that are rather arbitrary, like what state we came from, the color of our skin, you know, the religion that we maybe they can tell from the, you know, what we wear. That's very interesting to me, and would love to hear your perspective on some of what you've seen from that sort of viewpoint.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, particularly in the law firm industry and in big law. I think traditionally there's been sort of this almost cookie cutter kind of expectation of what a successful big law candidate would look like. So certain schools, you know, certain background. And I think that has been prevalent, but I think, you know, as we evolve and recognize the business imperative that is diversity, equity, inclusion, what comes from broadening, I think that has evolved. And I think that comes about through people making changes. I was the first Howard Law student that my law firm, when I came out of law school, hired through OCI, and that came about, you know, I had done the work in terms of my grades and being prepared, and I had other options, but it came about through someone internally really deciding that they were going to make the fight. At the time, we joke about it now because we have, you know, maybe partners that are from Howard Law, and it's kind of, it's the recognition that you know, there was just some challenges that were kind of left on the table, but it's through people deciding that they're going to make the change and being in the position to do that. And I think you see that in the industry, and you see how one person can make an impact, and you see how the benefits of that impact can help an organization grow. So I've benefited from that. And then in terms of how I process that, I think it goes back to both my upbringing and also my education. I attended HBCUs before most people knew what the acronym stood for. I went to Hampton University in Virginia during my formative adult years. I was there from 16 to 20 years old. And it was there that I was just continually affirmed. Excellence was pushed on us and what we had to do. And we knew we had to be prepared for this world. But we also kind of left there, I think, with an armor that made us know and remember that we are valued. And if we are in situations or organizations that may not recognize that, that's sort of on them and not us. And mm-hmm. we can figure out how, you know, what we want to do in those situations. But, and then that's been kind of reiterated throughout my career. I went to Howard Law. And again, you learn excellence, you learn the craft, and you learn the business, but you also learn of your value and your worth. So for me, that has always been, as I said, just an armor when I walk into space. And, you know, you learn to use yourself when you're doing DEI work. And you can assess organizations and situations and figure out how to make change, how to impact change. But I think, you know, I feel like I've been sort of protected from any sense of worrying too much about what people will think about me or where I come from or, you know, whether I fit. And that's something that, you know, is a gift. You know, I work in these environments where, you know, not everyone comes in with that. And I try to pour that into people as much as I can. But it's a gift that I think is a part of just all of the decisions I've made in terms of my education and the supports that I've had related to that.
Well, what's interesting about what you're sharing about that, Manya, is, you know, your family and your immediate sort of circle can think the world of you. But if you're in an environment where you're getting these mixed messages and you're being devalued or second guessed, that has to take its toll, especially in formative years. You know, you described 16 to 20. I had a former guest who had started to, you know, have kids, and she had a young son. And her husband, she was from Barbados, but they were living in the UK. And they actually made the really difficult decision. They loved living in the UK, but they actually moved back to Barbados for, you know, similar reasons as what you described, like, you know, going to a historically Black university. They knew that the policemen there would be Black, the judges would be Black, the teachers would be Black. And they made that difficult decision for the benefit of their kids. Not that that's a solution, everyone should do that, but the principle, I feel, is very resonant.
Yeah, and I think it matters, and I think you can't undervalue the excellence of that. Like you said, not everyone, we live in the world that we live in, so you don't mm-hmm. always have that option. But I think, you know, recognizing the absence of that and then finding other ways to build into it, because as you said, you can go into these organizations where you're underrepresented and it can be debilitating, you know, not having anything to do with talent or even necessarily the organization itself. You know, that's one of the joys, I think, and benefits and why I'm grateful to be in the position to be in these institutions where you have programs, you have resources, you have commitment from leadership, and you can still miss the mark. And that comes from the one-on-one interactions, the microaggressions, the feelings of being othered, and being able to give voice to that is something that I think is really impactful and that people can recognize and are starting to recognize. I appreciate the conversations we're having about how difficult these environments can be without looking at people as individuals, looking at the kind of systemic and organizational structures that can foster those feelings.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, and I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, you know, being in big law, especially early days, right? Like this isn't like, you know, 2020, this is, you know, prior to when people were more enlightened about these sorts of things. Just thinking about, in a way, your success was included a lot of mentoring and sponsorship. Like someone had to say, like, I want to invest in Manya, and that doesn't always happen. So I'm always thinking that it's like, it's not enough just to get into the organization. People, every advance I've had, it's because someone took an interest in me and they developed me and they knew something that I couldn't teach myself. And they said, Joe, let me teach you something. You can't understate the importance of people seeing you as part of the team.
Absolutely. And I definitely had that. When I, in addition to the attorney who hired me out of Howard Law, you know, you're on case teams, you're in an organization that's, you know, that's predominantly, you know, the dominant group. So there you can't succeed in those environments without allyship and without mentorship. I think, you know, in those environments, what I did and what I tell people, the thing that I can control is my commitment, the time that you put forth in mastering your craft, because you're asking a lot of anyone. And I don't think as a general matter, people go into these organizations and determine not to mentor people or not to sponsor, but I think it matters in terms of who people are going to invest their time in. So I think as an initial matter, the onus would be on me or someone in those organizations to be as best as you can. And this goes back to Tonya Robinson, who was just the epitome of excellence and grace as you're learning. And I think that's a very foundational aspect. And from there, you do have people who pour into you, who are, they see the value that you add and are willing to invest in you. And I had a number of mentors when I was coming up, largely my peers. You know, you think about law firms and I tell junior associates, you often talk about partners or getting the partner's time. And that's really important. But when you're coming up sort of in the trenches, it's your peers. And, you know, I had white cisgender male attorneys from Ivy League schools that we were all in the trenches together. And that support has been invaluable, both in those times and throughout my career as well. So, but I do think it starts with how you are able to invest in yourself because, you know, time is valuable. We're running sort of billion-dollar business enterprises. So, you know, no one is required to be nice or to invest in you or even necessarily to owe you anything just because you're there. So I think recognizing that and investing in yourself is something that pays off in dividends.
Yeah, I heard something so interesting. We had a panel discussion at KPMG recently on the path to promotion. And, you know, one of the senior executives, we were talking about sponsorship. And she said, you know, very insightfully, sponsors pick you. You don't get to pick the sponsor. And similar to your peers, who they picked you, Manya. They saw something in you because of the way you invested in yourself. And they said, this is the type of person I want to be associated with, I want to learn from, and I want to be able to share and teach as well.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
All right. Well, curious to pick your brain on this next question. You know, things are changing so fast these days, you know, on various levels, from a business level, from an ESG level, from a generational and technology level. From your perspective, what do many people get wrong about how to succeed in today's current working environment? And how did you come to this realization?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it's great to piggyback on what we were talking about. One of the first things I think that comes to mind in terms of what people get wrong, and I'm reminded of, you know, the late Honorable Judge Damon Keith, who was just a phenomenal human being, I mean, a legal giant and very impactful in the legal and judicial industry, but just a wonderful person. And one of the things he would say, and the Keith family is just, it's just phenomenal. And he instilled a lot in all of us. And one of the things he would say was that no one has to be nice to you or no one owes you anything. And I remember walking through the streets of Detroit. We were based in the Sixth Circuit, but my judge sat in Detroit, and he was just so kind and would stop and speak to everyone, and people knew him. And I remember that sort of resonated with me, and even in the professional setting. And I think that's something that I tell from a coaching aspect, my attorneys and juniors, when you come in, whether you're diverse, whether you're, you know, dominant group, top of the class, come from the best law school, no one owes you anything. Mm-hmm. And I think coming into an environment feeling as though you're owed something from your employer or from the people that are around you can really get in the way in terms of what you are there to do and what you have to offer to the organization. It's great if people invest in you. And I do think, you know, when organizations bring people in, you have a responsibility to provide an atmosphere for people to grow and to learn and to advance. But I think it's a very slippery slope between that and this feeling of, well, I'm here and, you know, you should do this, or I'm feeling this way, so you need to do this or need to occupy. I think sometimes getting caught up in terms of what others owe you or should do can really get in the way. And I think you have to separate the should from a requirement and have a way to sort of pivot and understand how you're going to do what you need to do in those environments to be able to thrive and to survive. And I think to ascertain whether or not it's an environment for you. But I think a lot of times, and it may be generational and kind of how we're learning and how people see their employer and their employment in these environments. But I think ultimately coming in and understanding no one owes you anything. And that's not to kind of absolve organizations from, as I said, the fiduciary duty I think they have to provide professional responsibilities. But I think balancing the two is really important, and not to get sort of a spectator sport of what people are going to give you just because you're there. And I think that's just something that was instead. You appreciate the opportunities and the gratitude, but you also understand your role in it. And again, you know, no one is here to just sort of, you know, open doors for you necessarily. And that may sound hard.
Mine is tough, like her mom.
I know. I think I've balanced it a little bit more than it may be sounding now when I'm talking, but I think it's a reality. I think it really is a reality. And if you kind of arm yourself with that, I think it prepares you for the sort of proactiveness that's needed to survive in these environments. So it's a bit of tough love maybe, but I think it's helpful advice.
Yeah, I gotta say, I think this is a really powerful and mature mark of a mature kind of thinking and professionalism about that. You mentioned, you know, one word that always makes, you know, me think of this should, right? This feeling of people should, well, you know, maybe they should, but this is what you got. What are you going to do about it? It's kind of making that shift into dealing with reality rather than, you know, getting stuck in your hopes for the ways things should be. That never improved anything. Like, only taking action based on what you get is the thing that helps.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. And again, it doesn't mean that you absolve organizations from what they, quote, should do. But yeah. I think it's just so much value in taking control of what you control. And that's what, on an individual level, when I have new attorneys coming in, you know, that's one of the things I try to instill, because I think that's really important.
Love that. Love that. Well, it's been great learning a little bit about you, you know, in the run-up to this and sort of your relationship with Tanya. And I love seeing all your events and awards and accolades on LinkedIn. So people may look at, you know, social media, Manya, and be like, hey, you know, she's got it all. But I feel like for all of us, you know, we all have our own struggles, which maybe we don't necessarily wear on our sleeves for various reasons. I'm curious what you'd be willing to share. What is one challenge you still grapple with at this point in your career that most people may not expect or realize?
I appreciate that question. I was having this conversation with my husband too, because I do realize that the posts and the events and everything looks it looks great and it looks fun, and it is. I am very grateful. But it's balance. And we talk about social media, what you see is sort of a snapshot in time. And I think the challenge of what people may be surprised is how much work that is. Like right before you see the pretty snapshot of everyone in there, I'm there for a reason. I have a responsibility to the attorneys that I serve and to the clients that we have, and making sure that our resources are, being used in the right way, and every opportunity is being used. So all of those things are happening in the midst of that. And I think that the challenge, I think, is the balance, because although I'm no longer practicing as an attorney, so I don't have the pressures of the billable hour, this work is nonstop. And it is still, I still very much work in a client-driven mode. So whether my clients are leadership in the firm that I'm working with, or the attorneys that I serve, or my peers in my organization, or my team members. So it's nonstop. It's not a 9-to-5 job. So I think the balance is really figuring out how to do this on a regular basis, which means, in the middle of the night, you have thoughts, you have ideas, you're trying to push things, you have people that need you. And then as we go through seasons of life, understanding the importance of family and friends and spending time with, I have a 9-year-old daughter, and balancing all of those things. I think, one of the things that at least I thought when I was 22 was that at this state, I will have the balance of all the things. And I think you learn that when you are passionate about what you do, and when you have expectations, and when you feel like you have a responsibility both to your others and an opportunity to make an impact, you don't really turn that off. So you can't really take your foot off the gas. I mean, you can, but you're not in this, that's not how you're wired. So I think figuring that out is still a challenge. I think recognizing that is important and that you have to do it is really helpful. But, I think that that didn't go away when I stopped practicing law, which is also what I told myself, like, oh, once I stop practicing, I can have all of this time to do all of the things that matter. And I've come to realize that I have high standards for myself and what I can do and what my expectations are. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm taking away from that, and really loved how you broke that down, is this sense of, in a way, sometimes having the pressure to always be on, but also needing to balance other aspects and priorities, frankly, of family and friends, in your life, and just also having the energy to do not just work, but the other things that are important to Manya in her life, like finding that energy and that passion so you can deliver and be there while you're there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great. Well, let's widen the circle and a little bit and proceed to the shout out. Who is a leader who is passionate about diversity that you'd like to shout out?
And just one, right? That's a really...
Oh, you can do more than one. You can do more than one. I mean, we don't want 100, but you can do more than
you
one.
You don't want 100. No, I do think it's important because, one of the things that I transitioned from a practicing attorney into this space, but it's not a space that you can come in and do well and be effective just because in a law firm environment, just because you practice law and you also happen to be a member of an underrepresented group. Those two things don't. So I would like to shout out Sakari Pinnock, who is the program director at Georgetown University's Continuing Education, and she runs the executive certification program in strategic management around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I was I had the pleasure and honor of going through that program shortly after transitioning into this role. And it was really pivotal in teaching sort of the foundational elements of what moving diversity, equity, inclusion is in an organization, and how to structure that, and how you use yourself, and how cultural norms and awareness come into play. And it's just been really impactful and a light in terms of how I do this work. It's added to everything else that I have experienced and come, and it has just been foundational in terms of that. And that program just turns out DEI professionals in many different industries, not just the legal industry. So I just think Sakari is just a guiding light. So I definitely would shout her out. The ALFDP community, which is a community of law firm diversity professionals, and we sustain each other. We uplift each other and could not do this work without that community, which is just a source of light. And then this is it. So it's not 100, but 3. I think I mentioned the attorney who came to Howard Law and first brought me to WilmerHale. And that's Ron Machen, who now is the chair of the litigation department at WilmerHale. And at that time, he was a counsel newly elevated to partner. But I mentioned Ron because what he has done for the legal industry, for diverse attorneys, clients, women, it has literally changed the trajectory of lives and of organizations. There are so many of us that have benefited from Ron's mentorship and opportunities that he's provided people within the firm. He's former U.S. attorney for D.C., and there are a number of U.S. attorneys, peer groups that are leading litigation firms, and everyone just sort of points to this one individual who is a masterful attorney, but then also just so influential and has really had an impact on the legal careers of so many people in so many different industries and all walks of life. And I think it really says a lot when you are not just benefiting yourself, but you are really adding legacy to this industry. And Ron Machen is someone who has done so much. He's also clerk for Judge Damon Keith. And we often get together and talk about, I know that Judge Keith is his hero. And wow. I've been able to share with him some of the things that I hear people say about him and his influence that I know he feels about Judge Keith. So my shout out, ultimate shout out, would be to Ron Machen, who's the department chair for litigation at WilmerHale.
Wow, I love all those shout outs. And as you were sharing, especially about Ron, you know, it makes me think a lot of people can feel hopeless and despair and be like, what can I do? What can one person do? And as Ron's example, and as your life shows, a lot. You can do a lot to lift other people up and make a huge difference in more than one other person's career. It's amazing.
And that's really the best way to make a difference. You know, we all are here for a finite period of time. So what we're able to pour into others is really the baseline. And Ron is someone that really resonates with.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Manya, it has been a real pleasure and an honor to speak to you today. I'm so glad Tanya put us in touch. How can people connect to learn more about you or the organizations you support?
Great. And thank you. It's been an honor to talk to you. A very bright spot in my day. And I'm on LinkedIn. People should feel free to reach out. I've done so much in the legal industry. So if you're interested, I talk to students all the time, junior attorneys. I talk to, you know, people at every aspect of their career, and just really happy to talk and share and listen. So folks should feel free to reach out anytime. I'm happy to be part of community.
Great. Well, thank you, Manya, for being our guest on C-Suite, the show that combines surprising leadership insights with a focus on diversity.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to C-Suite. Alpha's purpose is connecting Latino leaders for impact. To learn more, go to alpha.org. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review or share with a trusted friend or colleague. Remember, with the right perspective, amazing things can happen.